Welcome to Section 9. My name's Damien Hull.
And I'm Dorothy. And this week is all about our new network. We're going to be discussing power outages, best practices, and migrating devices. So on Wednesday, we had a little bit of a problem with our production network. We had a power outage. How prepared were we?
We weren't very prepared at all. The only thing that we had on our network to sort of save us in this case was our UPS. So when I woke up on Wednesday morning, the UPS alarm was going off. So I had to find myself a flashlight. And in the dark, I had to make my way to our little office here. And then I had to figure out how to shut things down.
So how difficult was it for you to try to determine? I mean, what was the biggest challenge for you, I guess?
Well, this was early morning, so I'm not quite awake. And I'm having to think about what we have and what needs to be turned off. And of course, the first thing that popped into my mind was our Synology disk station, because that's where all of our information is. That's our file server. So I shut that down first, and then I had to think about the rest of the network. What else do we have? And that's when I remembered our VMware server still online. So I had to go into our ITOP system, where we have documentation, which is on a completely different server. And I had to get the username and password to log into our VMware server. I was able to shut that down. And then I kind of made a mistake. I ended up shutting down our Meraki firewall, which also does our Wi-Fi. And I happened to be on my laptop using the Wi-Fi. So now it becomes a bigger deal, because now I have to figure out how to get myself back on the network. What IP addresses do I have to use for that? Because now I have no DHCP. And it was just a mess. But I managed to shut down our last server and made sure that everything was taken care of, so we were safe.
Yeah, so one of the things that I kept thinking as you were telling me all this is, you know, gosh, we were lucky that you were home still. You hadn't gone to work. But what if you would have been at work? I mean, how would we have dealt with this? How could you have turned everything off remotely?
No. So in that case, the internet was off because there's no power. So there's no way for us to remote in that particular situation. So one of the things that I have been thinking about is ways in which we can have our systems automatically shut down. And you can do that with a UPS. There's actually a USB cable you can plug into the UPS, and you connect that to a computer. And then when the power gets shut off, there's special software that you install to recognize that the system is now on battery power. And then when it gets down to, let's say, 15 minutes of battery power, you can have the system automatically shut down. And there are more advanced setups where you can get a UPS with a network card that will broadcast out to the network and shut certain systems down. We don't have that option. So we're going to have to figure out how to use the USB option and maybe plug that into a Linux server and then have the Linux server detect the battery backup systems on battery and then begin shutting down other systems for us. I don't know if that's an option yet. We're going to have to do some research on that. But that's one thing that we may end up looking at. And the other option is that we need to replace the battery backup system we have with one that is compatible and has the features we want.
Well, I wonder how that's going to work with our legacy devices. But one of the things that I'd be curious to find out when you do your research is, will this software know what device to turn off first? You know, like, if something needs to be turned off before something else, so then it could operate. I mean, is the software going to know this? So I'll be curious to see if it does that. So we got through that chaos and realized we didn't have a recovery plan, a disaster recovery plan. So the next thing that we realized is we need to up the ante and start working on our production network. So go ahead and explain what we did.
So yeah, in order to have a disaster recovery plan, you have to know what you have on the network. You have to know where things are connected. So once you have a situation like this, there are some things you can do to create yourself like a little quick disaster recovery plan. The problem that we have is that because we're testing things all the time, we're moving things around a lot, and we haven't been keeping up with our documentation. So when we go to create that disaster recovery plan, we don't know where anything is located. We don't know why things are connected the way they are. We don't know if this is a project that we're working on or if it's a production part of the network. So we decided kind of to sort of immediately jump into repairing our network and building that new network that we've been talking about.
The production side of it.
On the production side. Right. And then we can go back to the testing side and figure out what we want to do with that.
Well, the testing is not so critical. And one of the things that we've been wanting to do, you know, we were running out of IP addresses. You know, we had a lot more devices. We needed to do inventory, do patch management and update documentation. And all of that was in the plan. Now we need to add that disaster recovery plan for it, since we already had the disaster. So, and even if we're a small network, you know, we still have data that we can't afford to lose. And we definitely don't want to lose some of the pretty spendy devices that we have in production. You know, we really want to keep them and make sure that they run for a long time. So looking at the problems that we faced, what was your plan when we started doing the production network?
So first thing I wanted to look at were best practices. Mm-hmm. What's a good way to design the network so that we plan ahead for the future? We have things that you're going to see in an enterprise environment so that we can add in the kind of security we want. And even though we're only two people, we want this to look like an enterprise environment. And we also want to make sure that in the future, when we add new devices or we want to do new things, the network can handle that. We don't always have to, say, for example, every 6 months redesign the network because we didn't plan ahead.
Right.
So the first thing I did was I remembered studying for one of the Cisco certifications. I think it was the Cisco Certified Design Professional. And of course, I used CBT Nuggets for that, watched the videos. And one of the things they talked about in there was making sure that when you have a large environment and multiple offices, you plan ahead for that. And one of the things they were doing there for IP addresses is using a /16. Now, if you're not sure what that is, you can look that up. But a /16 or for a subnet, that's a lot of IP addresses. So you're not actually going to use a /16 for the whole thing. That's too big. So what we did was we subnetted that into smaller /24s. So in order to do this, you have to know your subnetting, your IP addressing, and how all of that's going to work. So for the production side, we decided to use 4 subnets, and we're not using all of them. So there's a 4th one that's kind of extra.
So we did one for workstations and printers, correct? We did one for servers. We did the wireless, and then we had an extra one for growth or unplanned devices, however you want to call that.
Correct.
And each one of them had their own subnet.
Yes. So once we got that out of the way, then we had to figure out VLANs. So you went ahead and came up with a VLAN plan, and I had one in my head, but at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter how you do VLANs. But you wanted to have something that you kind of understood.
Right. Then we had to go into the Meraki and actually change the IP addresses for the different things that we did because we had created the new subnets. So that for me was a good learning experience. We actually started with the printer. You know, we thought it was going to be a simple thing, and it ended up not being so simple. You know, we went ahead and changed the IP address to the new one, correct? And then we made sure we had to figure out where it was plugged into the Meraki, correct? And as we were doing this, we were actually documenting what port it was in, what VLAN it was in, what the IP address was. So we did a really good job on that. But why don't you go ahead and explain some of the challenges that we had when we couldn't print?
Right. So the Meraki is something that's new to you. You've never actually logged into the admin interface mm-hmm. and tried to figure out how to manage things in there. So for those of you who don't know, the Meraki is a cloud-based solution. You have to go to their website and log in as an admin to go and make some changes to that. And some people don't like that, but I think for a lot of smaller organizations, it's a really nice solution, especially if you're a small IT department where you have multiple locations. And for us in this particular situation, it's actually worked out really well for us. And so we logged into that and I showed you some of the basics of you know, where to go inside of the interface and some of the information you can get from that. And then we went to the part where you add subnets and VLANs. And so we slowly started adding those things in there.
Right.
And then we had to figure out, like you said, where is the printer plugged in? What VLAN is that going to go to? So we had to move things around and then make sure that the right port was connected, and then we put that in the right VLAN, and then slowly we got that to work. But it was a process because there were things that we ran into as issues.
Yeah, and one of the things that it was my first time actually using the toner cable thingy, that was really interesting for me because while I kind of knew where it was plugged into, we couldn't go in the, I kind of guess, I'm almost sure that's where it's plugged into. We had to really make sure that that is where it was plugged into and that was the actual cord. So,
yeah. So we have a Fluke cable tester and toner. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay, this is a good time to practice using that because we could have figured out where that cable was because we don't really have a whole lot of cables.
We follow the cable. But again, we really wanted to make sure if this was an enterprise environment and it was really big and you don't have the luxury to follow the cable, you have to make sure that you have to know how to use that toner. And I didn't know. I mean, I didn't understand it. And you had to explain that to me.
Yeah. So in an enterprise environment, and this happens a lot, you want to go and move a device somewhere and you can't because you don't know where it's plugged in the server room. You know, where is it on the patch panel? What switch is it plugged into? A lot of times there's no documentation for that. So you'll have to get out a cable tester with a toner. And so what you do is you take the cable tester, you plug it in on one end of the cable, usually where the wall jack is next to the device. And then you get your toner out and you go back into the server room and you start looking on the patch panel to try to find what cable on the patch panel is connected to that port or that wall jack. And slowly you can begin to figure out where things are connected by doing that. And so you had to learn how to use that toner probe and figure out, okay, how do I know when I'm on the right cable?
Yeah. And I thought, oh, the bigger the number, the stronger the signal. And you were like, no, it's the other way around. So that was really good. And that brought me back to the Jeremy video on CBT Nuggets when he was talking about if you do it right from the get-go at the beginning and you label it and you make sure that everything is it's marked, it's going to make your life a lot easier. And for us, you know, when we did the printer and I changed the subnet mask, gave it a new default gateway, went ahead and gave it the new IP address for the new subnet that we were using, the very first thing that I did was get the label maker and put the IP address on the printer. So then that way, at least we know, you know, where that part of it is.
Yeah, and that's helped out a lot because now we don't have to pull out some documentation. We can turn around and look at the device and say, okay, that's the IP address. If it's a switch and I need to log into that, I look at the IP address and I just log in.
I think the scary part for me was what came next when we were trying to migrate some of the devices. Because at first I'm like, you know, my thought was, let's just start simple. We'll just do the printer. We only have one, you know, it was, yeah, I mean, we had a few couple of things in there, but it wasn't as bad. Migrating the devices was a little bit different.
Yeah. So we had to migrate like our Synology disk station, mm-hmm. our Gigabyte server. The Gigabyte server was a bit tricky because that does DNS and we made a few mistakes along the way. And there were other devices where we kind of did the same thing, but the DNS issue became kind of a tricky thing to troubleshoot. So this is what happened. We needed the Gigabyte server on the server VLAN. So we went into the Gigabyte server. We changed the IP addresses. We found what port it was plugged into. We made sure that that port was then switched over to the correct VLAN. Then we made sure we had access to that. But then what we found out was that DNS didn't work properly.
Right. We ping 8.8.8.8 and it was good. But then if we ping google.com, nothing. And that was like, we looked at everything. We had all of the IP address was correct in pretty much every place that we looked, right? But what was the thing that we missed?
So yeah, so there were just a lot of things that we had to change. So one of the things we did was we changed the DNS server option on the Meraki for all the DHCP servers we have for all of our different subnets.
Right.
So we made sure that was in there because that was one thing that we did miss.
Right.
So once that was done, we thought, okay, maybe now it's going to work properly. Still, no luck. And this is where documentation comes into play. This helps you a lot. So in the Gigabyte server, we're using Bind. And Bind is a DNS server. So I went in there and started poking around in the DNS configuration and come to find out that there is a place within Bind that you specify the IP address it's listening on. And I'm not sure if that's something that has to be there, but in this case, we are using that. And so the old IP address was in there.
Right. That had the old IP address.
So what happened was when we tried to go and use the DNS server remotely from another system, it wouldn't work because it's not listening on that. And it was an odd kind of situation because locally you could actually use the DNS server and it would work. You know, there's a command you can type in called dig. And then if you say dig at localhost and you put in like google.com, you would get a response back. So I was totally confused by that because it's like, okay, well, it is working and it's not working. And this makes no sense to me. So little by little, I had to troubleshoot that whole thing and go through all of the configuration files until I found the one where it's like, oh, look at that. And you even noticed that when you saw the configuration file, I said, okay, what's wrong with this? And you're like, oh, the old IP address is in there.
Yeah.
So even when you don't understand how something's put together, sometimes when you go through the configuration, you'll notice things that don't make sense to you. Like, why is the old IP address in there?
Well, for me, it was when you were troubleshooting and you go, oh, we missed one thing. So we went into every subnet and put, you know, the server IP address. I thought, oh, okay, you know, that's one of the things that I would have never thought of. But the one thing is when you looked in that file, as a newbie, I didn't really know what you were looking for or what you were doing. My thought was this. The old IP address can't be in there for it to work. That was my thought. So the minute that I saw it, it's like, that needs to be changed right then and there. So not that I really thought that I knew what I was doing. It was like, it was just like a basic thing for me. We changed the IP address. It needs to be changed to the new one. And then there is that old one.
Yeah. And there were some things that we ran into with certain devices where we had to move cables around because we, at one point, okay, we're connected to the network. We have DHCP, we have DNS. It's all functioning. Oh, look, now we don't have an IP address. What's going on? Oh, we have to move this over here to make this work. And then we also have an unmanaged switch, one of those cheapy ones that, you know, you get them for like $25 or something like that, because we don't have enough ports on our devices for them to be plugged in. So we're going to have to move things around so that on the production side, we have more enterprise-like devices, yeah, managed devices.
We don't really want to. Yeah, we want to phase out those unmanaged ones because, like you said, when they go bad, it's really, really bad.
Yeah, and I've actually seen some of these devices go bad. And luckily for me, this has been at home. And so when one of these switches goes bad, they just freak out and they stop working. And it's hard to troubleshoot that. And the only way you can fix that, at least in my experience, is you have to unplug it and plug it back in. But you have to know that that's the case, and it's just so hard. So on the production side, we're just going to remove them.
Right.
If we use them on testing, okay, I'm working on my project, I'm done with my project, I unplug it, it's off. So there's less of a chance that that's going to cause an issue someplace.
Right. Yeah, I mean, for testing, I can see that because, oh, we need one more port here, plug it in. But in production, I agree with you. We want to kind of have a clean network. Make sure it's solid. Make sure we have a plan, documentation, patch management. So, you know, but I learned a lot from what we did yesterday. Definitely migrating the servers, that was really scary. And the disk station, I was really nervous on that one because I know it had all of our data in there.
Yeah. And again, you know, when you do these things, there's a lot of steps in there. And we were talking about this yesterday. When you're studying for IT and you're watching like CBT Nuggets videos, or you're reading a Cisco book, they don't tell you about things like printers. Oh, your printer has to be migrated to the new IP address. What steps are you going to take to do that? And you have to make sure that you do it in the right order.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that I really want to do, you know, like we wrote everything down as we were doing it, which was good. When we get to do the documentation part of it to put it into ITOP, I really would like to have a checklist of, you know, this is what you do when you migrate this device. You need to be looking at this. You need to be changing the IP addresses here and here and here. You need to make sure you go into the bind file and, you know, remove the old IP address and put the new one. I want all of that documented because the next time that we do that, I don't really want to have that fear like, oh my gosh. And, you know, all that time that we spend trying to figure it out, it could be saved. I mean, I'm telling you, something else probably will come up, but at least what we've been through before, if it's documented, it, you know, it may be avoided.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's helping us out a lot, and it's going to help us out more in the future as we get more documentation put into ITOP, is the ITIL process. And ITOP, when you do the installation, you have a couple choices. You can do a basic help desk, or you can do an ITIL-based installation, which is what I always do. And as we go in there and put more information into it, we're beginning to see how that's going to help us out a lot. Because, you know, we're trying to focus on enterprise, trying to be more like an enterprise environment, more security-based. And when we get more of our devices in there, that's going to help a lot with security.
Well, yesterday, I was really glad we got a lot of the devices that we didn't have in there. And then some of the things that we worked through, we were able to put that into the documentation. And what's really nice is that if there was anything that is kind of not yet done, we were able to say this needs to be done to be able to go back. And then when we went back and did it, we were able to remove that. So I really like the tool. It's really, really good for trying to document the network, knowing how many devices you have, what kind of problems you encounter when either you migrate a device or you're trying to download a software or something on it. Or, you know, it's a really good tool. It's really impressive.
Yeah. So when it comes to disaster recovery, knowing what you have is really important. Knowing how they're connected is really important. So in that moment when, you know, the power's out and you're in the dark and you're having to shut things down, you'll have a process in place to help you figure out how to shut things down properly. And you won't have to think too much about that. And then when it comes to security, knowing what you have on the network is really important. And that goes back to the Center for Internet Security's top 20 security controls. One of the things they talk about and one of the controls that they have is managing your inventory, making sure there are no unauthorized devices on the network. And so as a security person, and especially now since I have a security job, one of the things that I think about a lot is what devices are on the network? What has been done to those devices? If a workstation is added to the network, why was it added? What's the configuration? What software is in there? Where is it? Are we doing patch management? Those are the kinds of things that I think ITIL sort of covers. Because when you look at ITOP and the process of adding something to the network, it asks you all these questions.
Well, one of the ISACA meetings that we were in, what I found really impressive, they were talking about the different ITIL tools. And, you know, and I think it had to do with HIPAA. They were trying to be HIPAA compliant. And somebody was going, what if I don't know how to use this? What if I miss something or whatever? And somebody actually said, actually, if you get that ITIL tool and you answer all the questions they're asking, it will do it for you. It will have the plan in there. You won't be missing anything. And I noticed that on ITOP. But one thing that concerns me is if we do not have access to get into the gigabit server or the gigabyte server, how are we going to get our ITAP information? So I would really like to have a hard copy, just like when we do our backups. You know, you have the main backup somewhere in the primary location, and then you have two extra copies, you know, one off site and then one, you know, on an external hard drive somewhere. I would like to do that with our documentation. It's nice that it's on ITOP, but if we can print some of it and have a hard copy, because if we don't have access to that and you're trying to shut down the VMware server, and let's say that you would have shut down the Gigabyte server by mistake instead of the Meraki, how are you going to get in there to get the password to be able to turn now the VMware server down? So, I mean, I'm worried, I'm concerned, and I think that should be part of our plan.
Yeah, and those are the kinds of things that we have to take into consideration. How do we make sure we have the necessary documentation for situations like that? Mm-hmm. And you brought that up when we tried to migrate, or when we did migrate the Synology disk station. We're using KeePass 2 to manage our passwords. And there's an FTP component to that where we're updating and accessing the actual database over FTP on the Synology disk station. So when we migrated that over to the new IP address, what happened to KeePass?
We couldn't get into it because it had the old IP address on it.
So we had to do some research online, figure out how to change that. And then once we were able to get back in, it was like, okay, we're safe.
Right.
But then the question is, well, what happens if the Synology disk station's offline? What are we going to do? So one of the things that we need to come up with is figuring out what information is important in the event we have something bad happen.
Right.
Where is our password database? Where is the instructions for shutting things down or bringing things back online? Who do we contact? And that's one of the things that I think I like about the ITIL process and ITOP. When I add in a device, whether that's a server, a workstation, a switch, there are multiple tabs in there and things I've never actually used. But one of them is like contact. You know, if I have, let's say I'm in a production environment and I have a VMware server, who's the contact for that? If I have an issue, who am I going to call?
Well, and this is part of the policies that we were trying to do, the policies and procedures for our network. You know, you were going to have me do the workstations and all the other devices. You were going to be doing the servers and what have you, and documenting who does what for accountability. That could be something else that you can put as a contact, like, you know, who updates the servers and does the patch management and does whatever they need to do. Your name and number will be in there. I mean, for us, it's only the two of us. We know each other's numbers. We don't need to really have them documented. But for the sake of a habit, a good habit, it's not a bad thing to sit in there and say, okay, this particular person does that. It avoids stepping on each other. And it also, you know, you're worried about your stuff. You know how this stuff works. I can come to you and go, okay, I don't know this about the server. How can you do this, that, and the other? Because you would be the one running that. So, yeah, I think that's a really good tool too.
And the thing that I think is really important to stress here is the fact that when you follow the ITIL process, there's documentation somewhere. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I kind of mentioned earlier is the fact that for security, you need to know what's going on with the network. You need to know what's happening with these different systems. And if you don't have documentation that you can access, documentation that's up to date and relevant, you're going to have to go to somebody. You're going to have to ask them. And if they're not there, how are you going to know? So you may end up making decisions about the network and security that could be wrong without that information.
Right.
So having ITOP there or some solution that you can come up with that has up-to-date documentation, you're training your IT people to put that information in there as they're doing things, then your security team can access that information and make much better decisions about the things they need to do to keep the organization safe without having to guess, without having to find people. They just access the information, make their decisions.
And ITOP is free. They have a free version, correct?
They do. And they also have a paid version, but we're using the free one. And there are other commercial solutions out there that are ITIL based. And that's something that we'll have to take a look at. And it's one of those exercises that I think is going to be good for the both of us.
Right.
So that we get an idea of what are some of the commercial options out there for disaster recovery, for things like UPS devices, for ITIL-based management solutions. And they call them also ITSM. I think it's IT Service Management. And that's kind of the commercial solution that you're going to look for out there. So these are things that I think we're going to have to look at in the future and I think are going to be beneficial to us. Anything else?
No, you?
No, I think that's good. We need to do some more documentation of the things we did yesterday. And I think we're on the right path. So if you have any comments or questions, you can email us at info@section9.us. And if you want to take a look at our show notes, you can go to section9.us.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.